When, if ever, should an individual be involuntarily committed for mental health issues? We will look at the debate over involuntary psychiatric care in the United States, the potential positive and negative consequences of this care, and whether or not this treatment has a role in the prevention of violence, suicide, and even mass murder. I'm Joy Cardine. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Have you or a loved one ever been subjected to involuntary psychiatric care? Have you ever tried to get a loved one involuntarily committed because you were afraid he or she would harm themselves or others? What happened? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Let me welcome our guest. Very happy to have with us Dr. Dinah Miller, a psychiatrist and instructor in psychiatry at the Johns Hopkins School of Medicine. She is the co-author of the book, Committed, The Battle Over Involuntary Psychiatric Care. And she joins us from the studios of WYPR in Baltimore. Good morning. Thank you very much for being with us.
Good morning, Joy. Thank you so much for having me this morning.
And welcome back to Madison via the radio. I understand your son went to UW-Madison.
He did. He graduated in 2013, and I've been there many times.
It's a beautiful.
I've even been to the National Mustard Museum in Middleton.
Good for you. That's a place you got to visit. First off, let's talk about involuntary psychiatric care. I think that phrase conjures up images of people being carted off in a straitjacket or locked up in a small room. What exactly is involuntary psychiatric care?
So that's a great question. So technically, involuntary psychiatric care is care that is mandated by a legal system for a person who does not want care. And it gets to be a sticky issue of what exactly you're calling involuntary, because sometimes people are told, listen, sign in or we're going to force you in. And people will say, okay, never mind, I'll sign in. And then they're voluntarily there. They've signed in. There's no legal system. There's no judge making a determination here. And they're technically a voluntary patient. But that person may say to you, well, I'm voluntary, but they made me sign in. And other times you get a question of somebody's told they're in an emergency room or in a doctor's office, and they're told you have to go into the hospital. So they go. And their version is, I was told I had to go. But if you walk into an emergency room and you're having chest pain and you're told you have to go into the hospital, you don't say I'm there involuntarily. You might have had dinner plans and you might not have wanted to go into the hospital. But you're just being a good patient. Yeah. So for our book, we took a very absolute line when we used people or their stories and interviewed them for the book, because the book is about stories. The line we chose was that the person had to have gone through the actual commitment procedure. So it wasn't just being involuntarily hospitalized. They had to go to a hearing within Maryland. It's an administrative law judge. In some states, you go to a courtroom. In the states we used, there was a hearing with a judge, and the patients had actually been committed. And yeah, that's the term for a legal determination.
And is it different from state to state as to how someone can be involuntarily committed to a mental health facility?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. So the discussion in our country of involuntary treatment isn't one discussion, it's 50 discussions. Mm-hmm. And that's probably not quite true, but every state has a mechanism whereby if somebody's mentally ill and dangerous, they can be hospitalized against their will for a period of time. And often people are at some point will decide to sign in, either because they realize they're getting help and it's a good thing, or because they feel like they'd lose at a hearing, or the hospital decides, oh, now that we've had a chance to observe you for a while, we're comfortable having you leave. And so that period is somewhere between 72 hours In most states, it takes a little bit longer, depending on usually the hearings are one day a week. So if you're admitted on the day of the hearing, it can take 6 days. We found in Vermont that it took weeks. And for some reason there, their rate of hearing was five weeks until somebody got a hearing.
So, I'm sorry, does that mean that they were involuntarily in a mental health facility for 5 weeks until a judge at a hearing determined it might be okay to go? Or took
yes.
that long to get them actually into the hospital?
No, mm-hmm. until a judge determined that it yeah. was okay to go. And I will tell you, this was an outlier. We didn't see anything else like that in any other state. And in fact, they were very thoughtful about the hearings and what they entailed. And for the most part, most people either sign in or they get better before that point. So they don't have a whole lot of people going to hearings, but they do have some. And in most states, the hospital prevails in a good 90% to 95% of the hearings. Psychiatrists don't want to keep people lightly.
Yeah. And in general, and I know it could be slightly different in different states, but the criteria, a danger to oneself or others, is that typically it?
Yes, but in some states the criteria is gravely disabled, meaning somebody can't take care of themselves. And even with the question of a danger to yourself or others, if somebody's homeless, walking around, can't get food, is putting themselves in situations where their life might be at risk because they're so out of touch with reality, or what we call psychotic, meaning they're hearing voices or seeing things that aren't there or have beliefs that aren't in touch with reality, delusions, then in some places people will stretch that meaning of a danger to yourself or others, meaning that you can't get medical care or take care of yourself in a way that's life-threatening.
Yeah. So
it's not just violence.
Why did you write this book? Is it to get people talking about the involuntary psychiatric commitment?
So in 2006, Ann Hansen, who's the co-author of Committed, and Steve Davis, a third psychiatrist, the three of us started a blog called Shrink Wrap. And we started it with the idea that it was a blog by psychiatrists for psychiatrists, mm-hmm. but psychiatrists weren't the only people who came and commented on things. And we noticed that when the topic got to be involuntary treatment, well, the comments got very heated. And the tenor of them was people who were distressed about having been involuntarily treated, or people who were angry at psychiatry that there even exists this thing of being able to treat people involuntarily. And so when you read comments from people who have been involuntarily treated and feel they've been treated badly or mistreated or that the system shouldn't have been able to do this to them, sometimes you think, well, you were sick and you don't realize how sick you were, and your behavior may have forced people around you to do things that there really was no other choice for. But when the comments come year after year, I think I started to think maybe there's a problem here. Maybe it shouldn't be that people are leaving our care feeling so hurt and injured. And I became interested in this topic of the battle over involuntary care, because like many issues that we have, it is a very polarized issue. Somehow you can be either for or against, and it's sometimes hard to find shades of gray. And around the same time that we're now years into this 11-year-old blog, Newtown happened, Sandy Hook, a young man with a psychiatric disorder, killed a number of children in a public mass murder. And right after that, there was the mass murder in Colorado. Actually, I think Colorado was a few months before, of the young man who was a graduate student who dropped out of graduate school and then shot people at a Batman premiere.
Right.
And people got very interested in this idea of if we could just force people with psychiatric illness to get care, could we prevent violence? And so I got interested in the topic.
Yeah. Well, we will talk about what you learned in terms of whether involuntary commitment can prevent violence. And we'll hear from some of the people you talked to in the book who were involuntarily committed. And we want to hear from listeners, too. Questions, thoughts, experiences. Do you think it's too easy or too hard to involuntarily commit someone to a mental health facility? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Dr. Dinah Miller is a psychiatrist. She is the co-author of Committed, The Battle Over Involuntary Psychiatric Care. Kendra in Milwaukee is with us. Hi, Kendra.
Hi there. I had a cousin who's passed away. She was repeatedly committed due to her severe manic depressive bipolar disorder. And I was wondering, do they have any sort of like mandatory support group after one is released from commitment? Because the problem is she didn't stay on her medication because of the side effects. And, you know, she was very isolated. And, you know, the same thing would happen over and over again. And I have a friend who's a social worker who talks about that in regards to law enforcement. People are mentally ill, psychotic, delusional. You know, they get arrested for antisocial behavior. They get sent to the county psychiatric center. They get stabilized. They get kicked back out into the world, and they come right back around.
So the yo-yoing from, you know, I guess from hospital to home to hospital and back again. Dr. Miller, what about, you know, is there any discussion on trying to stop that that cycle?
So I'm sorry to hear about your cousin who passed away. The direct answer to the question of is there any mandatory support group is no. There's not a mandatory support group. Some states have what's called outpatient civil commitment or mandatory outpatient treatment or just outpatient civil commitment, which is a legal process which requires people to have outpatient treatment. Now, 45 states have this. I live in Maryland and we don't. Many of the states who have it don't use it. It's very hard to enforce. How do you get that? When you think about the logistics of how do you decide who it is that you're going to mandate to get care, and then how are you going to follow that person? Because the following them gets very expensive. You have to have somebody paying attention to what this person is doing and, you know, on a day-by-day basis. Are they taking their medicines? Some people can be given injectable medications that are long-lasting. Are they coming for their injections? And what do you do when they don't show up? Do you want to take somebody, for example, who it's just a question, and I don't think we actually do this in many places, but in some places we do. If somebody hasn't committed a crime, you're talking about people who have committed a crime because you're talking about people in jail, but say somebody hasn't and they have bipolar disorder, and when they get better, they stop taking their mood stabilizers. And mood stabilizers do not come in long-acting injectable forms. So they stop taking their medicine because they don't want to, they don't believe they're ill, or because they have side effects. What do we do then? And I think society is really perplexed by what to do about this.
Yeah. And Kendra, I'm very sorry, too, for the loss of your cousin. Were you or was her immediate family involuntarily committing her because of suicidal tendencies, or was she voluntarily checking herself into hospitals, or how did that work?
Frequently, she would go on manic binges. Credit was easy to get. She would run up credit cards in this manic condition. And then on the other end, you know, and she did have family. She wasn't homeless. frequently, you know, she would also get into those depressive moods. And, you know, in order to get her back out of them, they would have to hospitalize her. Her last stop prior to her death was at a what they call a halfway house. And, you know, she felt she didn't have enough autonomy there. But, you know, her family did try their best. But, you know, as people get older, you know, the stress of taking care of someone 24/7 or day after day is very stressful.
Yeah, I can imagine. Dr. Miller?
Well, I think somebody who has a severe and chronic illness who needs, you talk about 24/7 care, and that's unusual with a psychiatric disorder. But for the small number of people with mental illnesses who do have severe illness that they can't care for themselves, we used to have state hospitals for them. And I have to say, many of them were not pleasant places.
Right.
But in the 1950s, we had about 500,000 state hospital beds. And right now in this country, we have 45,000 state hospital beds, and we have double the population of what we did back then. You know, many of those people did not need to be in hospitals. And so that was the tragedy of it. And they weren't pleasant places. And that's in and of itself horrible. But you do wonder if there are some people who would do better in that setting. It's not something I'm a big proponent of, but sometimes there's just no real... We're left with a hole in society is what do you do? And I think we want better treatments that people don't have bad side effects from. We want people to not have a lot of stigma attached to these illnesses, which unfortunately there still is. It's a system that can be very hard.
Kendra, thank you very much for the call. We'll take more calls for our guest, Dr. Dinah Miller, psychiatrist and instructor in psychiatry at Johns Hopkins School of Medicine, co-author of Committed, The Battle Over Involuntary Psychiatric Care. Does this treatment play a role in the prevention of violence, suicide, even mass murder? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Do you think that there are positive consequences to involuntary commitment or negative? Let us know what you think or if you've had any experience with this. This is the Ideas Network. This is the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine. We are talking with Dr. Dinah Miller, a psychiatrist who is the co-author of Committed, The Battle Over Involuntary Psychiatric Care. We're welcoming your questions and your own experiences at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. Have you or a loved one ever been subjected to involuntary psychiatric care? Have you ever tried to get a loved one involuntarily committed because you were afraid that he or she could harm themselves or others? Before we go back to the phones, Dr. Miller, I wanted to talk a little bit about there's a line in the foreword of your book that says the decision to force someone into treatment is rarely as straightforward and clear-cut as it is presented by those who debate the issue in academic circles. Why do you put it that way?
Well, it's a complicated issue. When somebody walks into the emergency room, and the emergency room is typically the portal for involuntary treatment, and I say walks into the ER, but they may walk into the ER with the help of the police.
Mm-hmm.
When somebody comes into the emergency room, you have all sorts of forces going at play. So people who often are in favor of involuntary treatment are often the parents of adult children because you're a juvenile child, you can a minor child, you can require to go into treatment, but they're often the parents of adult children who watch their children deteriorate, and be unable to enjoy the pleasures that life has to offer. These they become psychotic. They're unable to function, and it's painful for parents, and they'd like to make it easier to get treatment. So when somebody comes into the emergency room, we have the patient who most people believe people should have the right to determine their own medical care, but sometimes the patient might not be able to recognize that they're ill, as our caller suggested. We have the family who's watching somebody become very ill in front of them. We have a doctor who wants to do what's best for their patient, also wants to do what's right in terms of legal and ethical dictates, wants to be paid for their work, and also doesn't want to be sued for a bad outcome. And we have society, which worries about people becoming ill or dangerous or homeless and bothering other people. And we have the insurer, who wants to pay for as little care as possible. Yeah. So there are lots of forces here, and it gets very difficult.
One of the stories in your book is that of Eleanor, who serves as a case against involuntary hospitalization. Briefly, can you share some of her story and her experience?
So Eleanor, I think the most striking thing about Eleanor is she's a woman in her 50s, and she hasn't had a history of mental illness. But she has a really rough time. Her father has just died. She's been going back and forth across the country to help take care of him and then take care of funeral arrangements. For her, this brings up all sorts of traumatic and troublesome issues from her childhood, because she felt he was very abusive, both emotionally and physically. Her dog dies. Her husband has work out of the country. She's running her own business. She's out all day in the sun one day. She stops sleeping. She becomes very agitated. She feels like her body's on fire. She spends all night up one night writing a long letter to a client, which is an angry letter, which is something she wouldn't normally do. And when her husband comes back from the business trip, he notices she's changed and she's not sleeping. So they decide that she should go visit her gynecologist, because the gynecologist has just started her on progesterone. And she goes to see the doctor, who says she just looked so sick and everybody can get to a breaking point. And she walks Eleanor to the emergency room, which I spoke with the doctor, and she had never done this before. And she was also very aware of psychiatric disorders, because her own sister, the doctor's own mm-hmm. sister, had had bipolar disorder and had died of suicide by jumping from the Golden Gate Bridge. Oh. So this was, there's all sorts of tragedy running through. The number of people I spoke to who were on the caregiving side who had family members with mental illness was remarkable. And I talk about all of their stories in the book.
So Eleanor is essentially did not believe she needed involuntary psychiatric care and doesn't believe she benefited from it?
Well, so Eleanor came looking for help. And she was brought down to the emergency room, where she sat for 8 hours without being given any food, without having her issues tended to. She said people came in and kept asking her about her medicines. And after 8 hours, she and her husband got up and left. And so they're driving home. I think she was a good hour, hour and a half away from her home at the hospital. And on the way home, she started arguing with her husband. And he said, "Do you want to go to another emergency room?" And she said, "Yes." So Eleanor is in the parking lot of the emergency room, and her husband asks her, "Are you feeling suicidal?" Now, he asks her that because he had his own history of having bipolar disorder. He had been treated with lithium before their marriage and had since not needed it anymore. And he had been asked by his psychiatrist if he was suicidal. So he felt that he needed to be sure she wasn't. And when he asked her this, Eleanor started screaming. She said something broke loose in her. She felt like at right that moment she became psychotic. And she was taken into the emergency room screaming uncontrollably, at which point she was not left to sit for 8 hours. In fact, she was seen right away, and the doctor who saw her gave her an injection of a sedative. And Eleanor would have signed a voluntary admission. She came looking for help. Her husband was very relieved that she was going into the hospital. She wanted to be treated. But her feeling was that whatever medicine they gave her made her sick, because suddenly she became very delusional. And when she got to the floor, the hospital unit, she believed that the nurses there were trying to kill her. And she, in fact, she believed that one of them was sent by a relative from across the country. And so her thinking became extremely disorganized. As is often typical with people with mania. And it took weeks for her to get better. But no one ever asked her, will you sign in? Because she was screaming when she went into the emergency room, the emergency room doctor wrote a quick 3-line note and involuntarily hospitalized her. Nobody gave her the medicine and came back and reevaluated her and said, can we send her home? She was hospitalized by a California statute for being gravely disabled, but in fact she was well nourished and her husband would have been able to take care of her. And had she gone home with an outpatient referral, we don't know what would happen. I suspect that she was so ill. I mean, it was really a rough 3 weeks in the hospital. She was really quite delusional. I suspect he would have brought her back. But I don't know that. I don't know if she could have been managed as an outpatient. It doesn't seem so from the story of what went on in the unit.
Well, let me, and we'll talk about the flip side, Lily's story, who had a better experience than Eleanor, in just a few minutes. But we have so many callers who want to weigh in. Let's go to John in Grand Rapids. Hi, John.
Good morning. I'm just very concerned. I'm glad you're addressing this issue. I work with children and under Chapter 938 of the law, which in Wisconsin is juvenile delinquents, and also spills over into Chapter 51, mental health. But from personal experience, too, I could tell you the HIPAA laws need to be addressed as it concerns particularly young adults who are held against their will. It is nothing short of state-sponsored terror to know that your child is not where they're supposed to be, and a mental health institution will not confirm or deny that they've been held. The family is the greatest support system that that child has, and they're not allowed legally to get any information about detentions when they occur. And ironically, it's up to the subject, the one who is allegedly mentally ill, to make that call. Yeah. And then the parents get the bill for it. So yeah. I have a number of huge concerns that I tried to address with my congressman, and he said, hey, it's a state problem. You got to deal with that institution. I'm like, that's a federal law.
Yeah, the HIPAA laws are hard on parents with young adult children who they want to help and support. But as John said, had a hard time even, I guess, finding out what was going on. Any comment on that, Dr. Miller?
So I think the HIPAA laws are very complicated. But I think that healthcare professionals and hospitals often don't understand them. So from a psychiatrist's point of view, I practiced before HIPAA. We didn't release information about our patients without permission even before HIPAA laws. But somehow there became this increased concern at the time of HIPAA laws. And sometimes what you have is that somebody comes in and they say, it's fine if you talk to my family, or they aren't asked. And a family member calls looking for them, and the unit clerk says, HIPAA, I can't talk to you. And nobody puts down the phone and walks to the patient and says, hey, your parents are looking for you. Can I tell them you're here? Do you want to give them a call? So that's not always the case. But I think we are sort of stuck with, if you have an adult who says, I don't want information about me released to this family member, should you be able to do that against their will? I don't think there's anything wrong with the doctor or the hospital or the people treating a patient saying, look, it's our procedure to include the family. You need to do that. And only if they say, look, no, my family is abusive. I don't want them knowing anything. Because you have that right. Doesn't a person have a right to say no?
Yeah.
So I don't like what HIPAA laws have done to people taking care of patients in terms of the misunderstanding of the laws.
Yeah, this is a hypothetical, but it's drawn from a real life experience where a young adult was involuntarily committed because of a suicide attempt. And barely survived a suicide attempt. And then the treatment, this young man who has severe depression, I'm not sure what else, is making his own decisions as to whether he should have electroshock therapy. I know he's an adult, but he's barely an adult, and he's mentally ill, and he almost killed himself. And there's problems like that, too, Dr. Miller.
Generally, if people are competent, we don't make decisions for them. And competence is different than dangerousness.
Mm-hmm.
So if somebody understands they're depressed and suicidal and doesn't want electroshock treatment, I have to tell you, until I started, there is a chapter on involuntary ECT in the book.
Mm-hmm.
But until I was writing this book and was asked if I wanted to write a chapter on it and come visit a unit where people had involuntary ECT, I didn't even know it existed. I didn't know that psychiatrists could give people ECT against their will. I don't know. Would you want to decide it? It's, you know, maybe it's somebody who's 18 and maybe it's somebody who's very depressed, but there are other ways of treating depression. Generally, involuntary ECT is used when somebody is incompetent. So they're either not in a situation where they can make mm-hmm. a decision, or they're just not speaking. They're so ill, they're not speaking. But
right. Well, let's move on to another caller, Randy in Sparta. Hi, Randy.
Hi. I have a friend of mine whose wife just got her, I'm not sure, third or fourth DUI. And before their marriage, she was in treatment three times for sure previously. She's like 55 years old, and he's been trying to get her committed, and he needs two other family members, they said, to sign off or whatever. And she's drinking like a 30-pack of beer a day, has lost six jobs since the first of the year, and it's just getting real crazy.
Well, what about, Dr. Miller, do you have some general comment on someone who is abusing alcohol or illegal drugs for that matter, and the family is afraid there's going to be a death, maybe even an accidental overdose because of this?
Well, I think in the case of all the families in these stories, it's hard not to have a tremendous amount of sympathy for them. In very few states, are there laws that allow you to involuntarily treat somebody with substance abuse? So you're not talking about somebody who has a mental illness in terms of being incompetent. You're talking about somebody who's choosing to use a substance that's destroying their life. And unfortunately, we have way too many people in this country who are doing that, just that. I mean, look at the opioid epidemic. I wish I had some answer for you, but there are states where you can involuntarily commit somebody for substance abuse. You can't in Maryland, and you can't in most states.
You know, it's interesting, and Randy, you might want to follow this. Here in Wisconsin, the state assembly just passed a bill that would extend the state's voluntary and involuntary commitment programs for alcoholics, which I guess is already on the books, to those who habitually use other drugs. This comes as a response to the growing opioid problem in the state. So many people overdosing and dying from their opioid or heroin addiction. So what do you make, Dr. Miller, of laws like this in Wisconsin, where it's now going to apparently become maybe easier to commit somebody with substance abuse problems?
I think one of the things we have to ask is, and there's not yet real research on this, but does it work? So if you follow a population of people that you've involuntarily committed to substance abuse programs, do they get better, or do they have the same outcomes? And I'll tell you that while most states don't have involuntary substance abuse programs. Usually what happens to people like the woman that you were talking about who has all these DUIs is, for one thing, the book that we wrote was about civil commitment, about people who haven't committed crimes. Once you're in what's called the forensic or the legal system and you've committed a crime, it's a whole different story. And six DUIs is committing a crime. This is not somebody who's not dangerous to society. So I think the issues get different there, and the courts have leverage. But often what happens in those stories is that the family gives the patient or the person not a lot of room. They start saying, we can't live with you like this. You're going to have to move out. Their spouses say, look, I can't live like this. We're going to need to get a divorce. And somewhere between the legal system and the personal system, people start saying, okay, I'll get treatment because my life is falling apart. The person you're describing has a very bad alcohol problem.
Randy, thanks for the call. Much luck to you and the family of this person. We are talking with Dr. Dinah Miller. She is a psychiatrist. She's an instructor in psychiatry at Johns Hopkins School of Medicine. She's co-author of Committed, The Battle Over Involuntary Psychiatric Care. Do you have a question for her or an experience to share? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. This is the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine. We are talking with the co-author of Committed, The Battle Over Involuntary Psychiatric Care, talking about when, if ever, should an individual be involuntarily committed to mental health facilities and whether or not this helps or hurts. Does this treatment have a role in the prevention of violence or suicide? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. Dr. Dinah Miller is our guest. Again, we have lots of calls, but I'm going to ask you, we should, as promised, talk about Lily, who had a different and more positive experience when it came to being forced into a hospital. Because of lack of time, can you very briefly tell us about her story and why it benefited her, Dr. Miller?
So Lily's story is shorter because she doesn't have a list of complaints with the system. She became ill at a more conventional age than Eleanor. She was in her 20s. She was in college at one of our nation's top colleges. Like Eleanor, she felt her illness was precipitated by the death of her father. She became rather depressed afterwards. But she developed what eventually turned out to be bipolar disorder, and she was hospitalized against her will. She'd had an episode of a suicide attempt and had been hospitalized. But in the story, we use an episode in which Lily becomes convinced that people are trying to frame her for a serial murder.
Yeah.
She sees things in her room that are moved. She's calling the police on her graduate school supervisors. She's having a really rough time. And when she was required to get care, she saw this as a turning point. She did not go to her hearing because she was too sick. She thought it was part of a plot. So she was committed to the hospital. She got medication, and she felt it helped, and it turned her around, and things got better for her. I will tell you, she never really got back to quite the level she was at before the illness, but she lives independently. She has a job. She has friends. She has pets. She volunteers. She's a productive member of the community. And things did turn out well. Yeah. Actually, things turned out well for both women.
Well, that is, even though one had a more positive experience than the other. Okay. We have, let's go to Tona in Bayfield now. Hi, Tona.
Hi. Nice to talk with you. I work as a person who does the emergency detentions for a couple counties in Wisconsin. And I don't know if you hit on this yet, but like when we do when we call an emergency detention, if the first thing we ask them is if they're willing to go voluntarily. If they are, we don't ED them. And secondly, if they do get ED'd and they don't agree with it, they do have the opportunity, of course, to represent themselves in court and you know, give their side of the story.
Tona, what ED means, emergency detention? What does that mean?
That's what you guys are talking about right now.
Emergency detention is what ED means, though. Okay, I just didn't know those initials.
Yeah. And anyways, the thing that I found most interesting is how many people have no idea that they can be emergency detained. And now with Facebook being such a prevalent part of our society, we have a lot of them that come, you know, via Facebook. A relative becomes concerned because of something somebody posted and such. And they're pretty amazed that we can hold them because we feel that they're a danger to themselves.
Oh, so it's not all that difficult, Tona.
Well, I mean, there has to be other, you know, that we can't just go by one posting. There has to be other things, but your psychiatrist guest there's hit on them. You know, what's their history? Have they ever had a relative that suicide, you know, before? And, you know, there's other things that go into it, too. But it's interesting that, you know, Facebook has become, we've had a lot of things get posted on Facebook and have people brought to us, too. You know, do an assessment for emergency.
Right. So I suppose if someone says, I'm going to kill myself or something like that, that's taken very seriously, Dr. Miller?
Well, in every state, there's a mechanism where if somebody is mentally ill and dangerous either to themselves or someone else, and usually it's to themselves, the emergency room doctors I spoke with said at least 90% of the time the issue is a danger to themselves. There's a mechanism in every state to get somebody treatment and get involuntary treatment if need be. So, yes, certainly that exists if you see on your friend's Facebook page or your relative's Facebook page that they're talking about committing themselves, or not committing themselves, hurting themselves or hurting somebody else. There is a mechanism to at least get an evaluation.
Mm-hmm. Well, what was did you come to a conclusion whether or not involuntary commitment did prevent violence or suicide or even mass murder?
Well, those are three different questions. I guess you know when we're. Dr. Hansen and I are both mainstream psychiatrists. Neither of us either asked the question of should there be no involuntary treatment. I think we feel like there are times where there's really just no other choice. I think we feel like that it needs to be carefully thought through, and that if you're going to involuntarily treat someone, it should be very kind. That we need a kinder, gentler system. But I think you're asking about, does involuntary treatment help prevent violence? And so I'm going to leave you with the statistic that from the best we can tell, mental illness is responsible for 4% of the violence in this country. If we could wave a magic wand and cure all mental illness tomorrow, we would still have 96% of violence. Violence is much more clearly correlated with substance abuse, anger, and early exposure to violence than it is to mental illness. I'm also going to give you the statistics that 1 in 5 Americans suffers from some type of episode of mental illness in any given year, and that half of us will experience an episode of mental illness during our lifetime. So when you're talking about using involuntary treatment to prevent violence, you're throwing a very wide net. I don't think that the issue of involuntary treatment to prevent violence or mass murder on a public health issue has a place in the discussion. And that's just from the statistical 96% of violence is not related to mental illness. But on an individual issue. If somebody's sitting in front of you saying, I'm hearing voices telling me to kill people, and they're refusing to go in the hospital, and there's not another less restrictive means of keeping people safe, of course, on an individual basis, this is an issue. There needs to be and there is a mechanism to get someone treatment when you're worried about imminent danger.
Yeah. And you think that part, I know it's a minority of the cases, but that part where someone is afraid that their loved one who's hearing voices telling them to go kill people, it's easy enough to get that person committed involuntarily?
If they're psychotic, they're hearing voices and they have beliefs that aren't real, it is possible to get them care involuntarily. The question gets to be, what happens when this problem is chronic and they don't have a history of violence? So you don't know. There's a degree with psychiatric disorder, and this is the issue in favor of making it easier to get laws to treat people, that you're left not knowing when somebody might become violent, or if their history of violence is remote, when exactly is that line that somebody could become unpredictably ill? And this is not a public health issue. This is an individual issue. And the other question is, what if you're just watching your family member who's not at all dangerous, but they're out of touch with reality and they can't go to school or they can't have a job, and you're watching somebody just wither away who could be helped by care? And these are complicated issues. We don't have a mechanism, if somebody isn't bothering anybody and they're just sick, to force them to get care if they're not. And they may not know how ill they are.
So because we only have a minute to go, and I apologize to callers who wanted to share stories. It's a very complicated issue. Are there alternatives to involuntary commitment?
Well, I think the issue isn't there are certainly cases where there's no alternative. But the question gets to be, like in Eleanor's case, did you offer this person voluntary commitment? Are there at least less restrictive options? And I know in Maryland, if you're in the emergency room, these questions have to be answered. Are there less restrictive ways of treating people? And so you're left to say, what else can we do? I was just on vacation for a few days in Iceland. And in Iceland, the number of people in the hospital who are involuntarily there is something like 3.7%. It's very low. I don't know why that is.
And what is it here?
I think about half of people who come into the hospital are involuntarily admitted there. The very few end up going to hearings. Yeah. And part of it is sometimes, I heard one woman called me from California, and she was telling me her story, and it seemed very clear to me that this person had needed to be in the hospital and would lose at a hearing. And I said, why didn't you just sign yourself in? And she said, well, because I was told that if I signed myself in, my insurance wouldn't pay for it.
Oh.
But basically, the insurance has a cutoff that they often say if somebody's not dangerous, they're not going to pay for the hospitalization. So it's not even an issue of doctors.
We got to leave it there because we are out of time. Thank you so much for being with us. Dr. Dinah Miller, author, co-author of Committed.